weeknights at 7 on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Good afternoon. It's a minute after 3 o'clock. Terry Gross has the day off. My name is Danny Miller, and this is Fresh Air.
Pete DiPoli, you're a famous cook. You know all the recipes in the book. But while you can cook most anything, there's one thing I want you to bring. I don't want salami or any pastrami, but Pete, won't you pass a piece of pizza? Oh, please pass a little piece of pizza. So keep your spumoni, don't cook macaroni. But Pete, won't you pass a piece of pizza? Oh, please pass a little piece of pizza. Salami, pastrami, minestrone, macaroni, ravioli or spaghetti. But pizza is the best dish yet. Oh, where is the pizza? Can't wait for my pizza. So please pass a piece of pizza, just a piece of pizza, please. Hartford, my good friend Di Pasquale, he makes the finest pizza in the land. In San Francisco, I go to my friend Lupo, he makes me eat the pizza with my hand. And in old Chicago, I go to see Granato, he makes a pizza that is simply grand. And when I'm in New York, I go to Luigino, and with my pizza, I just have a glass of vino. I don't want salami or any pastrami, but Pete, won't you pass a piece of pizza? Oh, please pass a little piece of pizza. So keep your spumoni, don't cook macaroni. But Pete, won't you pass a piece of pizza? Oh, please pass a little piece of pizza. Salami, pastrami, minestrone, macaroni, ravioli or spaghetti. But pizza is the best dish yet. Oh, where is the pizza? Can't wait for my pizza. So please pass a piece of pizza, just a piece of pizza. Please pass a piece of pizza, just a piece of pizza, please.
We open Fresh Air today with singer Jerry Colonna's Pass a Piece of Pizza, Please, a rather mild stereotypical reference to Italians. We'll talk about some other ethnic images and stereotypes later on today's show with Gail Stern, the curator of the Ethnic Images and Advertising exhibit at the Balch Institute in Philadelphia, and Charles Hardy, the producer of the Popular Culture Show and a consultant to that exhibit. Gail and Charlie will join us at about 3:40. At about 4:15, I'll speak with actor Dorian Harewood, who recently appeared in the films Tank and Against All Odds. You may also remember him from his appearances on the television shows Strike Force and Trauma Center. He'll be starring in two upcoming TV movies based on the lives of singer and pianist Nat King Cole and the Black Olympic champion runner Jesse Owens. With me now in Fresh Air is actor Cleavon Little, who is appearing in Philadelphia in the title role of The Emperor Jones, a music theater dance work based on the Eugene O'Neill drama. The Emperor Jones is one of the American Music Theater Festival productions currently in Philadelphia. Cleavon Little has appeared in a number of stage and screen productions, including the leading role opposite Gene Wilder in the Mel Brooks movie Blazing Saddles, which was made in 1974. In 1970, Cleavon Little won a Tony and a Drama Desk Award for his portrayal as a black preacher in the title role of the musical Pearlie, in a cast which also included singer and actress Novella Nelson. By the way, Novella Nelson is also in Philadelphia, appearing in the American Musical Theater Festival production of Trio at the Philadelphia College of Art. Before we meet Cleavon Little, let's listen to this excerpt from the original soundtrack recording of Pearlie, featuring a duet with Novella Nelson and my guest, Cleavon Little. This is called Down Home.
Toll a bell, Big Bethel. Toll that big black ex-liberty bell.
Tell freedom there's death in the family.
All these wings and they still won't let me fly.
All this land, all we get is 6 feet when we die.
Don't tell me how the breezes blow. The daisies nodding to and fro. The cotton fields as white as snow. When freedom doesn't grow down home. Down home. Body can't be free, Missy, down home.
Berry picking ain't no treat. Picking in your natural feet. The country summer ain't so sweet. It's just a lot of heat down home. Down home. Before you start your beat. Down home.
You can have your black-eyed peas.
The morning glories and the trees.
You just can't do the things you please. Crawling on your knees down home. Up north.
Where?
That's the place to be, up north.
North?
Oh, yeah, that's
north.
Where I'm going, uh-huh.
Huh. You are seven, living in a roof, up above a cheap saloon. Your future tied up to a broom. Pearly, freedom doesn't bloom up north. Down home, a body's better off down home.
I'm sick of flopping in this shack. Paper stuffing in the cracks. And toting around a burlap sack. The world gets on your back down home. Up north.
No, Pearly.
Sister, picture me way up north.
Picture you up north, John.
Oh, yeah.
I see you sitting on a concrete step. I see you picking nods and threes to bed. You ever loving a soul in debt? That's the deal you get up north. Down home, a body's better off down home. The to your prayer, it ain't a living up no flight of stairs. It's having you a fairer share of this old country air down home. Down home, just a fairer share down home.
Lord, if I could live to see freedom on a willow tree, growing sugar sweet for me, how pretty life could be down home. Down home, how pretty life could be down home. Dogwood ain't about to bark, and you can't hear a meadowlark like just before it's dark down home. Down home, it's peaceful when it's dark down home. The ties upon that vine are strong.
Georgia is my home, sweet song.
Ain't no one gonna treat us wrong or tell us that we don't belong. Down home, I know. sweet sister Missy.
Yes, Curly.
Down home.
From the original soundtrack recording of Pearlie, that was Novella Nelson and my guest Cleavon Little singing a duet titled Down Home. And Novella Nelson, by the way, happens to be in Philadelphia. She's appearing in the American Music Theater Festival production of Trio. My guest, Cleavon Little, is appearing in the leading role of The Emperor Jones, another American Music Theater Festival production, which is now at the Port of History Theater, which is at Penn's Landing, and that's on through July 15th. And here's a number for more information about that. That's 925-0600. That number again is 925-0600. And Cleavon Little, it's a terrific pleasure to welcome you to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure being here. It's interesting. I was just thinking about Emperor Jones. There were a number of Jones involved with Emperor Jones. Brooks Jones is the correspondent producer from Summer Fair. James Earl Jones originally was supposed to do it until he had gotten a film. And my mother's maiden name was Jones, so there are a lot of Jones.
A lot of Jones going around, the Emperor Jones. Yeah. You know, you were just saying while we were listening to that recording from Pearlie that it had been a long time since you heard it. That was, what, from 1970?
Yeah, we opened in 1970. That was it, and it's been quite a while.
Have you had a chance to catch up with your colleagues from the show, like Melba Moore and Novella Nelson?
They've all been in different places. I just recently moved back from Los Angeles, and Sherman Hemsley, of course, is doing The Jeffersons. The last time I really saw him, we did a play called The Charlatan, and he was asking me for some money because he didn't have any, and he said that Norman Lear was going to do a pilot. He was going to try to get an advance on that. So I gave him whatever I had. And he, of course, I'd like to go see him about some money now. And Novella, I have seen periodically throughout the years. I have not seen her maybe in a year or two. I think I was doing some project in New York. Melba, I haven't seen in quite a while. But, you know, we always run into each other at various times.
Did you figure you'd be a performer when you were a kid?
Yeah. It was sort of inevitable. I used to dream about it, and it was always something unconsciously, subconsciously, I was preparing for. I really didn't consciously make any effort toward that until I was a senior in high school. I decided prior to that I'd go into business or play baseball. In my last year of high school, I said, well, let me try this. And, of course, I did very well, the school I went to, which was quite interesting because it was in San Diego in the Navy projects, which was predominantly white, and the school I went to was predominantly white. And I decided to take up drama, and the teacher I had there was a lady named Betty Hall, who was quite magnificent, and I was the only black in the class. And she'd put me in all these good roles, regardless of what the situation was. I did Time Out for Ginger, and I did The Curious Savage. In one, I played the doctor, and the other, the banker. So it all worked out. And from that point on, I realized that this was what I was called to do.
Before you found a more artistic output for that type of expression, did you cut up a lot in school, or did you do stuff like that?
I think I talked a lot in class. I did less study, more talk. Always liked talking. And my mother once told me, she said, boy, you're probably going to make a living talking. And little did she know how prophetic her words were then. No, I didn't really cut up. I've always had a sense of it, and I do some practical jokes every once in a while if I get an opportunity to do that. And I don't mind them being played on me, too, as long as they're not painful.
Well, if later on you want to share some of them, feel free. What do you think was your most valuable early professional experience when you decided to move to New York and become a professional?
You mean after moving to New York or prior to?
No, well, when you moved to New York.
I'm not sure if I'm clear about that. I know one of the early experiences just prior to moving to New York was to actually, when I think about it, I met Novella Nelson. And Moses Gunn, they were doing a play in La Jolla. What was the name of the play? The White in White America. That was in Fred Pinkard. That's when I first met Novella. And I'd forgotten about that. And that was in 1965, I think, this summer. That was kind of my real first experience with black professional actors. Of course, New York was a number of experiences. One of the first one I had was with James Earl Jones, in which I played a guard in Macbeth. And right after that, of course, they had a casting for a play called McBird, in which they wanted a James Earl Jones type witch, you see. So I ended up getting a small role in it, running around and getting killed and all that kind of stuff. And that was quite exciting.
Do you remember, what was the spirit of the cast like on McBird?
McBird? Well, of course, you know, Stacey Keach is in it, Rue McClanahan, Billy Devane, John Plachet, a number of actors. It was a very rebellious cast. We, in fact, we wanted a part of the cast album. We didn't want just the flat fee. We felt if it was going to be successful, we should have a piece of the action. And we held out for that. We did get a percentage. It never made anything, but that was a real important beginning for me in terms of the rights for the entertainer and at least fighting for those artistic, creative, and financial rights and to be able to stick together. If you're really right about it, of course, one cannot be outrageously ridiculous about it. But we had a great time. It was a very controversial play, of course. We had bomb threats and we had big rats in the basement at the Village Gate.
Can you give an overview of what the concept of the play was?
Well, it was sort of based on Macbeth, the play. As you know, Macbeth deals with power and a man going crazy and his friend Macduff becoming or taking over as the head. And so they made a parallel with the death of Kennedy and President Johnson, having the implication was that he had Kennedy killed and all that kind of thing. Barbara Garson, I think, she was going to University of California. She wrote the piece. And that's how it all came about. It was an exciting production.
Do you think the show identified itself as part of the anti-war movement?
Oh, definitely. It was all part of that 60s movement. And it had its effect and its impact, I think.
Did you perform at rallies or anything like that?
No. You mean the show itself?
The show, or would people kind of rally around productions of the show too?
It was a very touch and go. It had a great audience. People did come to see it. It got sort of mixed reviews, but it was a successful show for that period in time. But it never took on. No one from the show went and represented any idea because they were basically actors who. At that time, we were sort of, we had no real political points of views other than we liked doing the show.
Well, in 1970, when you got the leading role in Pearlie, and out of that, you won a Tony and a Drama Desk Award. Mm-hmm. Actually, could you also give a sense of what Pearlie was about for people who haven't seen it?
Oh, Pearlie was about a country preacher who wanted to build a church or had some financing for his church, and he had sort of a distant cousin, Lutie Bell, played by Melba Moore, who came into town, and she had rights to some money, and he was trying to get her to get this old captain to let her have her money in order for him to build the church, Big Bethel. And it was all of his finagling and his conning to convince her, and she fell in love with him. And, of course, he was using her, and after a point we find that he loves her, too. It was a wonderful musical. It was a comedy and a lot of singing and dancing. It was a wonderful cast. Sherman Hemsley was in it, and Novella Nelson, of course, and Melba Moore. Linda Hopkins was in it, and it had great music.
Was it? Do you think it's fair to see it as one of Broadway's reactions to the civil rights movement?
It was no. I think it was Phil Rose, the producer, went into it. I'm sure as a financial venture, and it was an important play in that it certainly brought blacks to Broadway in great abundance. In fact, a great majority of them bust in from Philadelphia. Every weekend we'd have busloads of people. I've met more black people here in Philadelphia who said, "I saw you in Pearlie," than probably any other part of the country. And it created a wonderful audience. The black audience is probably, I think, without too much bias, the most exciting audience to perform because they do react to whatever's going on. And for the performer, that's quite exciting.
What was happening for black performers at that point? What type of opportunities did Broadway extend? Or off-Broadway?
Well, during the middle 60s, I'd say when I came to New York in 65, that was kind of a real renaissance. We had the Negro Ensemble, which was formed in that period of time. There were a number of plays that employed black actors off-Broadway. Broadway still was pretty much the great white way. Of course, after Pearly, and that would be periodic plays. I mean, Sammy Davis Jr. did Golden Boy, and I think Hallelujah Baby and Hello Dolly. Those shows were going on Broadway. But it wasn't until Pearly came along that someone said, we have an audience here that's untapped, and it would just pack in, pack. And so finally, after that, another play, Ain't Supposed to Die, came out, and it started doing well. And I think there was formed a group of people who actually went and got theater groups, black theater groups. And, of course, The Wiz came, and it just perpetuated itself to the degree that black Broadway could exist with a black audience. And that went along for quite a while. And it seems to have tapered off. It depends, and that may be because of the different shows. I'm not really thinking that we've had any real exciting shows, a lot of sort of nostalgic things, but I'd like to see some new created projects.
Well, it seems like a lot of, at least the more successful black-oriented shows have been like musical revues. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of like Ain't Misbehaving or One More Time or Sophisticated Ladies, which for what they were, some were really terrific, but not really seeming to focus on serious drama, such
and
as for what you're doing now in The Emperor Jones, or really you could also mention, I guess, X, which focuses on the life of Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's been true as far as what's been most successful?
That seems to be. It's one of my disappointments about Broadway as far as blacks are concerned, black talent, especially musicals, because what's happened, the musicals have basically, and I know I'll be under some criticism, but I think it's true, the musicals have basically employed singers and not actors, singers who can sing magnificently but are not that great in terms of acting. They're all right, some of them. But the singing has been the prime thing. As I remember when Broadway, and I never thought I'd go back to talk about what I remember, but I think it's true. It certainly was true with Pearly. Pearly had a combination of both, where you had some people who could sing and not act and vice versa. Well, the interesting thing about Novella Nelson could do both of them. She could sing and act. Melba Moore was basically a singer who had a natural ability for acting, comedy acting, and myself basically an actor and barely could sing. But that combination of all that added a great excitement, plus we had some great singers in the back, some great dancers. Now, if you can't sing, by and large, you can forget it. Now, there are some wonderful talents who are out there singing and acting, but by and large, most of your black actors are not doing musicals. There are a number of them who could carry a tune and it could work. And I'm more into character and story with musicals, and we haven't had that. I'd like to see some contemporary black musicals written about contemporary life with some contemporary music. That, to me, would be much more exciting than going back into nostalgic times. We've done that.
Yeah. Do you think Broadway is getting anywhere closer to the situation that you were in when you were in high school, where your teacher cast you you were black, but you were not cast in black roles. You were just cast in roles.
No, I don't see it yet. I haven't seen that yet. If you're going to do a musical on Broadway, it's going to be a black musical or a white musical. White musicals may have a greater tendency to employ blacks in certain minor roles, but they do that in films too. It has to change now because I think our country is far ahead of the entertainment business, which usually one would think the reverse should be. There was an interview with a particular black talent, which I won't mention his name, so on television, and the interviewer asked him, he said, do you believe that it's the industry that's causing the lack of black talent working or the public? And much to my surprise and great disappointment on his part, he said he thought it was the public, because I think he's absolutely wrong. I think the industry has people who are people who employ people, the producers, the directors, and some of the writers. They are afraid to put blacks in real substantial leading roles because they think the public will not accept it. I think it's wrong. I think the public wants to be entertained. They don't care what color you are. If you can do and move them in some kind of way or another, either make them laugh or make them cry, that's what they want. It's obvious. Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy are two great examples of that same kind of thing. And so I was disappointed to hear this particular entertainer say that, because how could he say that? But in any case, I think we have to have more producers and directors and writers who will take the chance and say, if you have a doctor or a lawyer in a musical or in a dramatic piece, you can make him black if he's a good actor. You want a good talent. Forget the color.
That seems to be happening a little bit more in television.
Ever so slightly. We're still not dealing with principal roles. It has to happen now just by the sheer fact we've had a black man run for president. I think that's probably, we've done everything when you think about it. It's a very strange way, and that's one of the important things that Jesse Jackson, I think, has done for my business, is that there's no excuse for anybody to say, well, I don't know if we can make that character black.
What was the significance of winning a Tony? Is that like instant money in the bank or instant recognition for your future career? How does that work?
Well, you probably have heard traditionally, when you win awards, you probably don't work too much. And there's a lot of truth in that for some reason.
Why is that?
Well, I think people assume then you're outpriced. They can't hire you because of that, and it's going to cost too much money. I'm not sure the total reasons for it. People do work. The Tony was a recognition and probably for me the most important award that I received, or one of the most important, because it had to do with my real peers, and it had to do with what was going on in New York, where people could see it every night, and you're really having a responsive audience. It has nothing to do as much with box office, I think, whereas I think that your Academy Awards and your Emmys and stuff have more to do on that level. And I find it real difficult because there should not be, if you're going to compare talents, you should have them all do the same piece, then make a comparison of which one is the best, you know.
My guest is Cleavon Little, who is in town performing in the American Music Theater Festival production of The Emperor Jones, and he is performing the title role of Brutus Jones. And that's now at Penn's Landing at the Port of History Theater through July 15th. In 1974, you were in what some of my friends know as one of my favorite movies, Blazing Saddles, mm-hmm. the Mel Brooks film, and you played Black Bart mm-hmm. opposite Gene Wilder. In a film, again, directed by Mel Brooks. Does Mel Brooks give very specific directions when he's directing a film, or is there a lot left up to the individuals to improvise?
Well, I have to preface this by saying when I did Blazing Saddles, that was Mel Brooks was just beginning to get into directing, I think, more so, because he was not aware of a lot of technical things to do at the time. At the time, he would have some specific things he'd want. He saw it. Saw the picture in a certain way. He also would allow the actors to find whatever they want, depending on their experience. Now, remember, my experience in front of the camera doing a film was not a great deal. It was a lot in terms of television. I was doing a series, so I knew technically where to move and all that. But in terms of allowing my own creative freedom, that was kind of new for me on that level, because television never really allowed it too much. It was so fast, and you didn't have the time. So that was the beginning of for me to learn how to open up. So I depended a great deal on Mel Brooks knowing what he wanted. And he was pretty clear about it. He had his own ideas. He also was open to let you find out what you wanted to do.
So is much of what you see on the film today, did that happen in front of the camera as opposed to...
Yeah. It happened out of what he wanted. A lot of it had to do with the writers. You know, Richard Pryor was one of the writers on it, and he contributed a lot. Unfortunately, he was not involved with it to the end. They fired him or something happened, I don't know. And that would have been interesting because I think a lot of stuff that he put in was taken out and should have been left in. As far as I was concerned, there were some other very funny things that I understand Richard had a lot to do with.
Are there things that you recall that were in, basic parts that were taken out, that Richard Pryor did? Because he's So brilliant. It'd be really interesting to hear what type of things he had
one,
in mind.
There's one moment that I loved, and I have a feeling it was part of what Richard contributed, and that was when Alex Karras, who played Mongo, when I first approached him, there were a series of events before I was able to capture him. In the film, it's just one event that captures him. That's when I come in with the telegram for Mongo. But in the whole piece, there were a number of events. And the first one actually was I was standing behind a little outhouse, and there was a cowboy, a ceramic cowboy, and he'd call the Mongo a name I won't repeat on the radio, but he'd call him this bad name. And Mongo, what are you doing, Mongo? And they count to 10, and so I start counting and to 10, and on 3, a miniature cannon pops out the character's chest or the statue and shoots Mongo. Of course, it doesn't faze him at all. Later on, the real reason I finally caught him was I played this French guy, and I say, monsieur, let me take your picture, please. I will take your picture. You just come here. And he had just gotten out of the well, and I put him inside this big cannon. I say, on the count of 3, smile, and I will shoot your picture. So I count 3, and I light the cannon and shoot him into another cannon. And that's how I finally caught him, actually. And that's how he ended up on the jail. Of course, he broke the chain, but it was outrageous. That was one of those kind of moments I like.
Of course, Blazing Saddles also had that moment when Mongo runs into town and one of the cowboys says, Mongo, Santa Maria.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff.
Which was did the production resemble very much a real Western in terms of where it was, what the setting was like, and so forth?
Well, I'm sure that's the only Western I've ever done. I'm sure it was. I think the whole objective to make everything funny is you put it in a real situation with these unreal situations occurring around it all. My character was the most sane character in the whole piece. With all the insanity, and that's really part of what made it the comedy that they had.
Did you have to learn about stage fist fights or stunts or horseback riding?
Well, that's part of my training as an actor. I certainly learned how to ride a horse while I was doing the show. An actual situation. I had 2 weeks to learn, and I'd get up at 8 o'clock in the morning. A wrangler would take me out, and I got on a horse, and with the horse that I had, and I'd ride around this little circle till I got used to looking like I knew how to ride as much as I could. Then I got in this big rink, and I rode. I came home that next day or that day, and I felt my behind. There was a big red blister on the back. So it stayed like that, and I didn't ride again. So I had 3 days of learning how to ride a horse. And after that, 2 weeks later, we were shooting the movie. So I had a girl one day stopped me. She said, you in Blazing Saddles, huh? I said, yeah. She said, you sure don't know how to ride a horse. So I said, oh, you know this time. But that's also workable for the character. It's all right for my character not to know how to ride. He faked it on.
Was it a pretty intense working environment, or was there lots of cutting up and relaxing, or was it both?
It was pretty much intense. I mean, we had a certain amount of time to do it. And we did it, as I remember. That's been over 10 years ago, so my memory fades with time, and it looks for the future.
Well, there is one scene that I know many people want to hear about right now, which is how the Count Basie scene in the desert was set up. Were you around for that? Because you actually rode in at the end of that scene with a Gucci bag, right?
Oh, you mean when they were setting up the whole... Well, I came in later, and they had already set the whole thing, worked it out. It was basically very simple. I just rode in and gave Count Basie 5 and rode off, and that was it. It was also the fulfillment of a kind of dream I had when I was a kid, and that was that I would ride in town on a golden Palomino. I actually had a dream and always wished that would happen. So if you ever see that movie again and you see the look, that was real memory recall. That was really the dream come true.
So what did you think about the farting campfire scene when you saw it in the movie theater?
I thought it was funny. I mean, you know, he just breaks all of convention. And it worked for me. A lot of people thought it was disgusting, but that's what makes it funny in a strange sense.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. That was that scene called those two different types of responses, but it really worked on the funny level. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Cleavon Little, who is in town, starring in The Emperor Jones now at the Port of History Theater at Penn's Landing, and he's performing in that through July 15th, and that's an American Music Theater Festival production.
And it's not comedy.
And it's not comedy, as we were talking before. It's a show with a black cast, yeah. Which is not just a review or a nostalgic look back or kind of.
Yeah, but it's, you have to remember, it's not a black play, whether that means anything or not. But it is a play written by Eugene O'Neill, and it's a combination of music and dance and drama, which makes it, I think, really uniquely exciting.
Well, how has the show been reworked from or added to from what Eugene O'Neill originally wrote?
Well, it's the original script. Everything in the original script is there. Basically, as you know, the story is about a man who's taken over and he has power on an island, one of the Caribbean islands, and he's sort of conned his way to be head of it by force and by conning, and he's there. At this point in time, Smithers, played by Kevin O'Connor, who's an English Cockney guy, he finds out that they're going to revolt against him, and he doesn't really like him because basically Emperor Jones even conned him out of his power position, and he wants to let him know he's got to run. And so the rest of the show after that introduction is about Emperor Jones running through, and the people have actually been working some voodoo on him. And so we get a lot of the voodoo dancing and rituals, and we see the deterioration of this man from a very arrogant, proud man to just dwindling down, and it's his own self-destruction. And the dancers become characters. The music becomes a character, and that's what, so that even though I'm carrying the show in terms of words, I also need the dancers. It's a real ensemble. I need the music in order to react off of it. And for my madness, finally, at the end. One of the things that I did, as you may notice, is I moved my hair from my head to my face. And so now I have no hair on my head and a lot of it on my face, which is strange because, of course, the posters they have are the very opposite of what I look, which may surprise some people. But I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted to do a character where I took all the hair off my head and tried to grow some on my face.
Do people react to you differently because of that, just in public?
Oh, I think so. I mean, they don't know who I am, but people do react to people who have no hair on their head and a lot on their face. For some reason, it's a little more menacing or threatening, and they sort of look at you a little bit different.
Is that role in The Emperor Jones, is that a hard role to play, both in terms of just the physical demands of playing the role, but also in terms of finding the character?
I can't say it was hard. I can say that it has stretched me. It has stretched me certainly emotionally, because every night there are those things that are happening. Physically, I love the fact that now I've been forced to get rid of my gut. I've had to do a lot of exercise. The dancers certainly are all trim, and they talk about me if I'm not doing that. And I have to move around a lot. So I'm real happy about that because I basically am very lazy about exercise. I hate doing exercise. But now, because I have a good reason, it is very good for me that way.
Do you think that the meaning of the role and of the play has changed very much over the years since it was originally written in terms of how the idea of the black man, the protagonist, is seen?
Well, the play is not about a black man. I mean, it happens to be a black man who's doing Emperor Jones. Emperor Jones could have been any color, because it's really about power, and it's about the deterioration of power over a period of time and what happens to the man when influenced by some other outside influences. We could very well say the voodoo never worked. We could very well say that it was all in his mind that these things happened, because he did a lot of bad things. He killed some people. But he was also a victim of his society, too. He could have been an Irishman who had gone off in some place where there were a lot of other poor whites, and he'd gone through a lot of different things. I mean, it's really basically not about just being black.
Right, but do you think audiences have made that division to say, well, there's the Emperor Jones in this play is black, but it really could be about any other other types of people, or do you think that the black identity of the character, since Robeson's done and it's always been he is a black character, does really affect the way audiences see it?
That would have to be individual. I don't know exactly, because you have different now with more theater to the masses and more black people coming and different people from ethnic groups. You a lot of your so-called intelligentsia are not coming only. So everybody's got a different experience based on their personal experience. It may be more personalized to some people and may not. I think it's just their own individual intelligence, which has nothing to do with how much you read, but some innate things.
The dialect in the play, the dialogue has a lot of I's and dems, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Do you use all of those?
No, I've had to try to get away from as much of it as I possibly can, because I think O'Neill was attempting to write black dialect, which is terrible the way he wrote it, but his ideas were there. And so I really, the difficulty in doing the role was going through and reinterpreting what he was saying and then how he was saying it and getting transferring that into that character and making it more palpable, because the audience they have to understand what you're saying. If I'm saying, gwine away from here, that ain't gwine to be, one says, well, where's the real person? And it's better to just say, gone away from here. I don't know where I'm going to be. This is much, much easier. And it's more realistic, too. And you can understand it.
Did you ever have a chance to see the Robeson?
I saw bits and pieces of it. I have not really seen it. It's an entirely different thing, because in the play, there's a lot of exposition about what's going on. Robeson in the play, actually, we see it, or in the film, we see that exposition going on. We see certain things, and they were more able to do that.
Well, it's been really interesting talking with you, and thanks a lot for being here.
It's been my pleasure.
Good luck with the rest of the run of the show. And the show moves on after Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, we'll go on to purchase at the Summer Fair in New York, and who knows, it may have a life after that.
Well, thanks again for being here today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Cleavon Little, who is in Philadelphia, starring in The Emperor Jones, and that's one of the American Music Theater Festival productions now in Philadelphia. The Emperor Jones continues through July 15th at the Port of History Theater, which is at Penn's Landing, and here's a number for ticket information. You can call 925-0600. That's 925-0600. It's about 16 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. At about 4:15 or so, I'll be speaking with Dorian Harewood, an actor who will be starring in an upcoming television film based on the life of Olympic champion Jesse Owens. And in about 5 minutes, I'll be speaking with Gail Stern and Charlie Hardy, who have both worked on the Ethnic Images in Advertising show. And this is Blazing Saddles.
He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way. When outlaws rule the West, fear filled the land. A cry went up for a man with guts to take the West in hand. They needed a man who was brave and true, with justice for all as his aim. Then out of the sun rode a man with a gun, and Bart was his name. Yes, Bart was his name. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light.
the opening theme from the Mel Brooks film Blazing Saddles.